City, John Grayson, Rob Ross once again talking over what's going on in the pop culture world. And Rob Ross, how is everything on your end of things?
Pretty good. I'm doing great, John. How are you this week?
Couldn't be better. Couldn't be better. Had a great conversation earlier this week that we aired on the radio with little Steven Van Zandt, and we got to hear some of his new music, and it's just great. So, yeah, things could definitely be worse.
So 5 minutes with Silvio and nobody whacked you, huh?
Exactly. I consider myself lucky on that front. But yeah, looking forward to a couple of things. And we found out, got word, and this is another interview that's going to come up on the radio fairly shortly, that the original lead singer and guitar player for 38 Special had recorded a solo album back in like 1983 or 84 at the behest of the label. They said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could go out on your own and do something as a side project to 38 Special? So he recorded this thing, and management changes at the label, and I know you know what that's all about, just dictated that the thing never came out. It just sat on a shelf for 30 some odd years. And after all this time, he finally got the rights back to it. So the album is going to come out, and we'll have a conversation about that in the not too distant future as well. And the great thing about that is that it's a, from what I've heard, a very 38 Special sounding record from their heyday. So still, the musicianship and the vocals and everything else is as it was when 38 Special was having hit after hit after hit on the radio.
What you said about management changes and what happens at record labels could not have been more accurate. I will tell a very quick tale about something I witnessed firsthand, but you just brought up the fact that an album that was recorded and never released, of course there are so many of those out
there,
but the good folks at Omnivore have just released or are about to release the, quote, legendary Fillet of Soul album recorded by Jan and Dean back in the 60s, which apparently rejected by Liberty Records. I mean, there you go. There's one of those rejected ones that of course, built up a sort of mythology, not dissimilar to when Save for Rainy Day, which was the first thing that Dean Torrance tried to release after Jan Barry's accident,
yep,
because all the songs on the album had a linking theme of rain and summer. And of course, once Jan had, quote, recovered enough to go back into the studio, he'd signed a deal under the name of Jan and Dean with Warner Brothers and did an album called Carnival of Sound, which didn't see the light of day until Rhino Handmade put it out in, I think it was either 2010 or 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That is so symptomatic of record labels going back to the 60s at the very least. I'm sure there may be some items further back that we don't know about, but there are tons of them from the 60s that, if not never saw the light of day, barely did. I mean, you and I have touched upon several of the most notably
Smile.
Smile, and of course, Farewell Aldebaran by Jerry Yester and Judy Hensky. But,
right.
You know, the years that I was at Atlantic, we saw a lot of this kind of nonsense go on. And it wasn't so much a change of leadership at the label, but the labels dictating one thing and then deciding at the 11th hour the next. And the most egregious episode I can remember was Jody Watley. Talk about a lovely, lovely person. I mean, never mind the fact that she is just breathtakingly gorgeous. I mean, you meet her, she is just a heart stopper, but such a sweet and kind person. She was working on an album for Atlantic, and they had her do a couple of sort of like run through singles as tasters before the release of the album, because they were marketing it towards the dance market. They even had her do a spread, which she was not keen on, for Playboy magazine. Well, guess what? At the 11th hour, they decided to not release the album, and all her hard work, which she valiantly complied with, things that she didn't want to do, she did because this was what the label wanted, and she's a professional, and they didn't release the album.
That is just horrifying. By the way, the Don Barnes thing, the 38 Special, Don Barnes' album is going to be called, it was called back then, Ride the Storm. That's the one that never came out, so be on the lookout for that. It should be released within the next week or two.
Predictable of record labels. What was it, Arista? Because I know that was 38 Special's label at one time.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yep.
Success. So, I mean, nothing ever surprises me when I hear about labels not releasing things, for God's sakes. But I also hear rumors, and I'm just saying this as very, very loudly, rumors that the ongoing big star excavations, if you will, are not done yet, because apparently there are tapes that are in the vaults, and I don't know how true this is, so I'm going to keep emphasizing that. There are tapes in the vaults of the Dolby Fuckers. And if you don't know who the Dolby Fuckers are, it was Alex Chilton and Richard Roseborough and a couple of other folks in the studio during the Radio City sessions. Two of the tracks that were actually recorded by the Dolby Fuckers, as they wryly called themselves, are on Radio City, Mod Lang and She's a Mover. So apparently there are other tracks out there. So stay tuned for what the future may hold for these.
Gotcha. And it was A&M, by the way, was the record label that Don Barnes was working with. Had the chance to look that up while you were talking. But yeah, they all had their management shifts and changes of mind and all of the things that you went over. So yeah, it does make you wonder how much of that is still hanging around.
Well, the one that I remember the most vividly, especially before I went into the business, was what happened to the Style Council when they presented Modernism A New Decade, which was to be their fifth album and subsequently would be their last album. They presented it to Polydor Records. Joe Munns, who was the head of the label, didn't like it. He'd just taken over, refused to put it out. Mm-hmm. And so it became the Great Lost Style Council album. It finally saw the light of day when the Style Council put out the box set, The Complete Adventures of the Style Council, in 1999. Now, Joe Munns was a guy who was very good at fucking up royally while he was at Polydor. He's also the one that had That Petrol Emotion and forgot to pick up their option. Thus, while the album Babble was starting to make inroads on the charts and get noticed by everybody in the press internationally.
Yeah.
Internationally. He let their option slip. And they wound up going to Virgin Records. And in the process, it killed off any momentum that Babel had. And the problem with that was that Babel wound up being Album of the Year according to Rolling Stone in 1987. This was an album that, I'm not kidding, REM were playing before and after every show during the Work tour. This was an album that, I don't talk about it often, but truly changed my life. And I mean profoundly.
Yeah.
Because that was the album and the band that made me decide to take the punchline in a direction that we hadn't gone before, where I said, you know what, I want us to stop being cute and poppy and twee and pseudo-REM and psychedelic, and I want us to get a little bit smarter and more literate and a little bit more social and politically oriented, because we're getting older and this is the way forward. You know, right down to even cutting our hair. That Petrol Emotion was the band that I always wanted to be in, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Babel was the album that really set the tone. I mean, I loved them from the moment I'd heard of them, because it was the O'Neill Brothers from the Undertones, but Babel was something special. It was an album of its moment that really had a major impact on me. You know, the same way I talk about Revolver or Number One Record or Sellout or Sound Effects or Murmur, so too Babel has that kind of pronounced effect on me.
Well, you know, this is going to end up being a really sort of self-referential conversation, because we're going to come back to Jan and Dean later on in it. And, you know, we mentioned the Stephen Van Zandt thing early on, and, you know, you talk about politics and music and being literate and understanding things and having some kind of social commentary, even more than politics, having some kind of social commentary to make. And that's one of the things that I ended up talking with Stephen Van Zandt about. Because famously, he is certainly a man of very powerful opinions, and he's not afraid to share them, but he's always drawn a line at what happens during his performances. He's not the kind of guy that's going to come out on stage and wear his politics on his sleeve. That's the time when you let the music speak for you. And the reason I ask him about it is because, even without mentioning him by name, there was a Roger Waters concert here in town about a month and a half ago. And this latest tour for Roger Waters has been about just skewering Donald Trump and all of his supporters, which is, in a way, fine by me, because fuck those people. But, you know, to Stephen Van Zandt's point, why don't you just write it in the song instead of having these giant, you know, Sony Jumbotrons that say, you know, screw Donald Trump or whatever it was? Why don't you just write it and perform it and let the music speak for you instead of, you know, trying to wear it, you know, on your t-shirt and put it up on the Jumbotrons and everything else and say it into the microphone? It just seems like so completely overbearing and a misfire on a number of different levels, but that's not the only place that Roger Waters is misfiring lately.
Well, let's take this in two parts. One, what you just said is absolutely correct, especially what, you know, Miami Steve said is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when REM were on their, what later became known as their final tour in 2008, and the biggest complaint that a lot of audiences and critics had alike was, enough browbeating with the politics.
Yep.
We get it. You know, we paid good money to see you perform. Entertain us.
Right.
Which is a key component to me. I don't want to be preached at when I go to a show. Even if I agree with your politics, that's not the point. I want you to entertain me.
Right.
Do your job. Now, I'm glad you brought up Roger Waters. Here's a guy who's made a career out of writing about his father's experiences in the war and the mental illness of his former bandmate, whose legacy he will never, ever be able to live up to. You know, a man who put out 3 singles and 1 album with this band and sealed himself as one of the greatest musical influences for all time. Roger Waters will never live up to Syd Barrett.
No doubt.
Roger Waters is insufferable. Roger Waters is pompous. Roger Waters is so unbelievably self-serving. Roger Waters is cannot be misconstrued, because what you were, I think, leading into is about his misfirings or his incredible raging anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and I don't get it.
Not anti-Israel, anti-Semitism.
Right.
When you send an inflated pig out over your audience with the Israeli flag on it, you're making a statement about Jews.
Yep.
He's a known anti-Semite. There's no obfuscating or trying to make the distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, because he's crossed the line far too many times. The lines aren't blurred. It's clear he's an anti-Semite. And because he's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, proponent of the whole BDS thing, and has found that other musicians aren't complying with his bully tactics, it's making him crazier. Case in point, I think the biggest target of his ire right now happens to be Thom Yorke of Radiohead. Now, I am not and have never been a fan of Radiohead. Nothing personal. It's just they never really did it for me. I don't get it. I never got it. Ironically, that people have always touted Radiohead for whatever strange reason as being the next Pink Floyd. I've never understood that. They've drawn those parallels. But nevertheless, Thom Yorke has been very, very outspoken in his anti-BDS stance, and his disgust and at points outrage at being dictated and bullied. And Waters has gone beyond the pale. First of all, Waters is not a politician. He's a barely literate musician.
Yeah.
Okay. He comes off like an ill-informed buffoon. But the fact is, he is so outrageously, pointedly, unidimensional in his stance. All this nonsense and excuses that I've read as I go along my way for people saying, well, you know, I think he's very pro-Palestinian because the Palestinian family took care of him when he was down and out. Now, maybe it had to do with something with the fact that he was fucking a married Palestinian woman who, in fact, was married to a Jewish guy at the time of her divorce, and he was going through his third or fourth divorce. You know, let's try and keep this in reality and perspective. You know, he was having an affair with a very well-known Palestinian-born reporter who lives in New York. So I don't think her ties to the, quote, Palestinians are that deeply felt, since she lives high on the hog in Manhattan. Enough is enough. I'm calling bullshit on this, you know, and I really don't care anymore what kind of backlash I might get. I have the right as an American and as an educated American and someone who is looking at all the elements and all the different avenues of the storyline and the big picture, as much as I'm not a fan of Morrissey or of Depeche Mode or Britney Spears, they all said, fuck you to Roger Waters.
Right. And I think more people should, for a number of reasons.
We're going to go have fun and we're going to play a show because that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And that's all I give a damn about.
You know?
How dare you? You know, how dare you? If that's the case, Roger, then maybe you shouldn't be booking dates in the United States since you're so vehemently against President Trump. Don't accept any royalty payments for any of your songs being played here.
Right.
You know? It's very simple. If you feel so strongly about it and you're just so opposed and your moral stance is so strong, then why don't you, who applies yourself to living in connubial comfort in your mansion, why don't you give all of your money to trying to help the actual people of the Gaza Strip who are victimized by their own leaders, the Palestinian Authority,
right,
the people who are keeping them oppressed and down, because it isn't the Israeli government, you dumb, ignorant fuck.
Ah, but see, that goes back to a conversation that we've had many times in the past, which is that this is 2017, where doing something, especially something that costs you either time or money, is not how you make a statement. You make a statement simply by saying things, and that's equivalent to doing something. So, yeah, in Roger Waters' mind, I guess that's the same thing, and he feels like he's done enough just by saying something about it, because that's the world we live in now.
Right. You know, it's like I was saying to my wife this morning, because we were having a conversation akin to what you and I are talking about right now, and it's, you know how we talked about the social justice warriors? You have to put a slash there and say, also going hand in hand with the social media justice warriors, because
right,
they're the ones that set the fire and fan the flames. And, you know, let's also, you know, take a deep rooted check here. He also accused the Israeli government of being like the Nazis.
Right. In those words, by the way, I want to underline that, because you're not exaggerating. He used those words. He compared them to Nazis.
Right. And you and I have had this conversation, and so have I with others. And it's the same shit over and over again. The co-opting of everybody being a Nazi. You know what? President Trump is not a Nazi.
Nope.
Okay. Our government is not the Nazi government. Okay. You want approximations to the Nazis apart from the Germans themselves? Assad's government.
Right.
The Iranian government. Kim Jong-un's government, and the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
That's a Nazi mentality government. Oh, I'm sorry, Roger. Are you approximating maybe the propaganda machine, comparing them to Goebbels? I mean, I love that. The fact that you Brits always do the same shit over and over again. You bring up the Fuhrer, and then you bring up Goebbels. You know? One with the – Roger, good luck. You're going to need it. Thankfully, you're old, and you won't be around much longer.
Well, right.
Anybody who buys any of your fucking records, well, they're being ripped off, because you are a hack. You'll never be Sid.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, here's a crazy idea. Write a good song.
I'm sorry, did you say write a good song in terms of equaling that with Roger Waters? He can't. Especially
right
now that Sid, unfortunately, is dead. You know, his one point to draw upon experiences from is gone. And, you know, there's always been something wrong with the guy, because apparently he had longtime problems with Rick Wright, who from all reports was a lovely guy. How is it Roger Waters is the only one who has problems with Rick Wright?
Yeah. Oh, I know. And you could run down the list of people, including all of his former bandmates who think he's an asshole. And they all seem to be pretty decent people as well.
Hey, I was about to say, and ask his four ex-wives, especially the last one, because the first words that she said upon taking the stand was looking right at him and saying, "You really are an asshole."
Yep.
So that's not an exaggeration either. Those are the words verbatim that she said on the stand. So Roger Waters, a hearty fuck you.
Thank you very much. And you know, we move into I want to get into a little bit of talking about TV, because it's not like this is going to make you any less animated, but still, we get into what's been going on. And I have to, my wife, bless her, has the worst luck, because it seems like every time she starts to really get into something, if there's a new show that catches her eye and she really starts to give heart and soul into getting into the story and getting into whatever it is that's going on the show and putting herself into it, that is the death knell of that show, because it will immediately be canceled. It's like, and this is also true of her, if we go to a restaurant, the thing that she went there for, they'll be out of that day. She has the worst luck with that as well. And so when you have that kind of, I mean, the reason why they make that entertainment in the first place in episodic television is to keep us coming back week after week after week after week. So when boneheaded decisions start to rip those things away from people, it hurts. I mean, it's still just TV, but still, there is that sense of loss with this stuff, and especially when it's something stupid that led up to it.
Well, she's not alone. I'm glad you brought that point up. Will I be animated? I'm sure I will, because it has one of my favorite themes in it, Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the incredible decision, the inexplicable decision by Cinemax to cancel Quarry after only one season. You and I talked about this show basically as it was on its run, because every week there was something else that they would put into it that I found either fascinating, remarkable, on point about Memphis, especially Memphis in 1972, or the fact that somehow they incorporated Big Star into almost every episode.
Yeah.
Apparently, the story goes that there was a second season about to happen. There was a complete shakeup of management at Cinemax, which is, of course, the cheap, weak sister of HBO, Skinemax, the home of titty films. And they decided they wanted to get – this is the part that I love. They wanted to get back to what made Cinemax on Friday nights the place to be by having more action shows like Strike Back and Banshee. Well, first of all, both those shows are gone.
Right.
And so their audience, they've moved on. You had a show like The Nick, which was a period piece. It was interesting and it was fascinating. And it was well acted, and it was very well received critically and by the audiences. You had Quarry, which was very well received by critics and audiences. You also have Outcast, which is a very strange and compellingly creepy kind of suspense slash horror series, which now, even though it was an immediate success right out of the box, they're on the fence about whether or not they'll be bringing it back for a second season. If they do that, they are cutting their own throats. But the fact that they dragged out Will There Won't Be a Second Season of Quarry from the time that the show ended its run in around December till the end of May, when word finally leaked out. It wasn't announced, it just leaked out.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be back, is infuriating. I did the only thing that I possibly could. I cursed out everyone at Cinemax, and then I ordered it from Amazon, so at least I'll have the one season.
Yeah, and it does. It sucks. I mean, when there's so much left to do, and that's the problem with a show like Quarry, is that it's not like some shows only have a season in them, and they say what they want to say, and they're done. This was not one of those. There was so much more to do.
Exactly. Simply, and I'll say this because it's a book series that is still going on
right
even now. So you could have continued it. Having said that, the way the show ended the season made it cyclical because the show ended the way it opened. So you could say in that respect, they may have had an inkling in case we don't get picked up for a second season, we've closed the circle. And it doesn't leave it open-ended. Which I think was a very, very astute thing to do. It was a very smart device to use. And I tip my hat to everybody who was on that show, the actors, the writers, everything about that show. And I'll be very, very blunt. And I've said this to my wife because she's now reading the books herself. I think that one season of the series was far and away better than the books, because unfortunately the books just kind of lack any spark. The show itself certainly had so much more verve and drive to it. And frankly, the books really don't take place in Memphis. You know, there's a fleeting moment when he makes a kill in the Memphis airport, but that's it.
Right.
The fact that the show itself based itself in Memphis in a certain time, they got the look down pat. It didn't look over-stylized for the time period. They incorporated the right feel of music. And the fact that, like I said, Big Star was somehow put into each and every episode, a brilliant thing to do.
Yeah, I got two things to add to that. And it's funny because that having music that's a part of your life show up in something that you dig is a very cool thing. And I mean, as much as you've talked about Big Star a lot, I talk about Roger Klein all the time. And yes, we will eventually get to talking about the new record that Roger Klein and the Peacemakers put out. But back in his tenure with the Refreshments back in the late 90s, their second album had a song on it called Wanted, and it's a terrific piece of music. And it's of all of the songs of theirs that tend to show up places, I hear that one quite a bit. And I was watching a movie one time called Clay Pigeons, and it's Joaquin Phoenix and Vince Vaughn. And it's a serial killer movie, a really weird one, but it's kind of a fun watch. And there was one scene where they walk into a bar, a little, you know, Texas honky-tonk kind of bar, and that's the song that's playing on the jukebox. And it was a little bit of something extra. It was like, you know what? I like this movie anyway. Now I really like it because they use that piece of music. It's cool like that when something you like a lot just kind of shows up and pops up somewhere.
Except in the case of vinyl. You know,
right.
The character picking up the copy of number one record and putting 13 on. Oh, that just made me angry. Very angry. How dare you?
Right. Like I said, it's got to be something you dig in the first place.
No, don't. But that scene in Quarry where the wife walks in, and as she's reaching the door, I hear the familiar strains and the riff of Don't Lie to Me. And she opens the door, and it's just blasting really loudly. And he's lying on the floor drunk. And he's got the album cover for number one record on his face. And she goes, what are you doing? And he takes the album cover off and he holds it up at her and says to her, when did this come out? You didn't tell me. And the thing that I had missed in the very first episode, and, you know, of course I went back and I rewatched it very slowly. In the very first episode, when he gets home, he's walking into the living room and he notices that one of his wife's first articles is a live review. Obviously, it was fictionalized and faked, but it's a live review for Big Star, having played that week. And, you know, they're now working on their first album. And
yeah.
I mean, that you can't put a price on that. You can't.
Yeah, and the other thing TV related that happened this week, we got so completely lucky because the new Netflix episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000 have been out now for, what, half a year almost? And they've started going around the country and doing a live show. And it's a little bit different than like the cinematic Titanic, which was Joel Hodgson's other thing after MST3K and some of the other live shows that they've done in the past. This one is much more set up like an actual live version of the TV show. But we got lucky in that a good friend of mine has been instrumental in putting all of this together. So I know a guy, and we got to go to their little VIP meet and greet before the show. And the coolest thing happened because there are people who have a sort of genuine honesty about them, and you don't need very long to pick up on it because they kind of shuffled us all through who were part of that. And I don't know, there were maybe 30 or 40 of us. And we all get to have our pictures taken on the set with Joel Hodgson and Jonah Ray, who is the new host of the show, and a couple of the other cast members. And you got a few seconds to say hi to them or talk to them or whatever. And I had no experience at all with Jonah Ray other than seeing him on an episode of At Midnight and knowing a little bit about his stand-up. So as we walked up, I just said to him, hey, man, great job with the new episodes. And in just the 2 or 3 seconds that it kind of, you know, his response to that, he just said, hey, man, thanks. But he said it in such a way that was so...
He almost took aback by it because he didn't expect that kind of forthright compliment.
Right, exactly. And I thought, you know what? I really like this guy. And for the 30 or 40 seconds that we were there and hung out with him, I just, it makes something that I like even better because I think that the guy who's doing it is a really good dude.
Well, you can't put a price on that, can you? You know, to know that it's kind of like the way I feel about the music of the Damned, because I know Captain Sensible, and when I met him, and you find out what a genuinely good, kind person he is.
Yes.
You love him even more, and you wind up loving the band's music. You know, you don't need to know about the politics between the band members themselves or whatever dissent, or, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, I know this is going to sound like I'm stretching it, but follow me along here. When I was, I don't know if I ever told this story or told you this story even off the air, but When I was 12, on the cusp of being bar mitzvahed, I was still a major Kiss fan.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, God rest her soul, as a surprise, wanted to do something special for it. She wasn't even sure what. And she wound up writing, unbeknownst to me, to Bill O'Coin, Kiss's manager. She took the address off the back of one of the albums and wrote directly to management rather than, you know, the Kiss fan club or Kiss Army, whatever they were calling it at the time. And I remember coming home from school one day, and there's a letter addressed to me from the Radisson Hotel in Minneapolis, St. Paul. The date was December 1, 1977. And I open it up, and it's and this is not a joke, a handwritten letter from Paul Stanley.
Oh, that's awesome. But, that's great.
You know, wishing me luck, you know, mazel tov on my bar mitzvah, I mean, the whole thing. And, you know, it was something that I treasured for many years, and like an asshole, I left it in my copy of Dressed to Kill, my vinyl copy, which I don't have anymore. Mm. So that letter is gone. But the point is that I was 12 years old, and I never forgot the fact that here was Paul Stanley, who was one of my favorite musicians at the time, taking 5 minutes of his tour, because that was the Love Gun tour, or what became the Alive 2 tour, to write me and wish me, you know, we all wish you the best now and always, Paul, and he, you know, Kiss, and then he put the star underneath it. And, you know, when someone does that, it connects you to them in a human way.
Right.
You love and appreciate them even more for it. The fact that I've spent a good part of this week listening to Kiss, don't even ask me why, because I have no idea. It just reminded me of that and what we're talking about here, because it's making that connection with somebody who is, after all, at the end of the day, a real flesh and blood human being with probably not too many dissimilarities from you.
Right, exactly. And it just brings that home again that, you know, just because somebody gets up on stage in the makeup and plays rock and roll, or because somebody's on TV, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be just as approachable and real as everybody else is. So it's nice when you see that happen. That's a great story.
You know, I do remember one thing about, especially when it comes to Kiss, because I remember both Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons talking about Dick Clark, saying that because people have, in fact, in one of those rare instances, praised Kiss for the way that they very often have been very accessible and very professional. And they said that they had learned that from Dick Clark, because the first time that they were ever on a TV show, it was a Dick Clark show, and he treated them with respect and professionalism. You know, here we are. We've never been on TV. We don't know anybody. We're nervous. And he put us at ease and treated us with the, you know, as if we were as if we were special too.
Yeah.
And, you know, that speaks volumes to me. And, you know, I will go to my grave always being a huge, huge fan of Paul Stanley anyway. So therefore, you know, it's that kind of notion that stays with you. And when you can make that, even if it's 3 seconds, 3 minutes, or 3 hours.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, when you make it, it's all of a sudden, and it lasts forever. That's very cool. We do have actually some new music to talk about as well, and there's something that you profiled this week on Popdose that I thought, in fact, both of them that we're going to talk about really, really impressed me in very different ways. Emily Barker, let's start with her, because she is somebody that I had not heard of before hearing what she's got in your review of her new album and hearing a little bit of the music. But the fact that, you know, again, somebody from halfway around the world who didn't grow up really with the same radio stations and everything else that you and I did, to have such a deep understanding of the kind of music that she's delivering is very cool. Where did she come from, first of all?
Australia.
How does she get Memphis? That evades me.
I think the most direct thing I can say without rhapsodizing, although I'm sure you're going to lose me somehow, because there's no way around it. I think the whole thing is the music of Memphis, taken in the broadest sense possible, has a certain something. It's a certain vulnerability, pure emotion, sexiness, gutsiness, ballsiness.
Right.
There's a real human grit that seems to make the music that comes from Memphis connect with people around the world. And it doesn't matter what genre, whether it was Elvis and the Sun Records, whether it was Big Star, a rock band, whether it was the music of Stax, Because if you've ever watched old films of the Stacked Soul Review in Europe in early 67,
yep.
those people are going absolutely bonkers in the best possible way. I mean, they were being lauded like demigods. You know, Dusty Springfield coming to record in Memphis turned her career around, you know. Memphis has a certain something. And that's the only way to phrase it, really. Yep. Oh, even a band like the Cramps, you know, by way of L.A., Ohio, and New York, wind up recording their masterpiece, Songs the Lord Taught Us, in Memphis.
Right, right. And really, I mean, the line from Memphis geographically to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, is not far. It's a couple of hundred miles, maybe. It's maybe a 2 or 3 hour drive. And so it's still very much in that sphere of influence. So you have to almost put in all of the sound that came out of Muscle Shoals with the Swampers and all the Rolling Stones album that they recorded there and Duane Allman and all of that into that same kind of ballsy, very real, very gritty kind of feel.
Well, keeping in mind, though, that the Stones recorded with Jim Dickinson.
Yep.
Jim Dickinson was, you know, by choice a Memphian. So that, you know, you have to take that into consideration. But, I mean, Emily Barker really hit it.
Yeah.
You know, she hit it. She hit it in that way that you're sitting there kind of going, holy shit, you know, because she doesn't sound like, you know, she would be this. The way it's presented before you listen to it, it almost feels like it's going to be one of those very light, airy, enjoyable albums. Not this gritty, soulful, unbelievable voice that comes out. Fact that she recorded this at the Sam Phillips Recording Service,
right?
You know, that's number one. You know, part of it is the fact that, you know, she loves the music that comes from there. You know, it's as she said, and I want to use her actual words, in the short amount of time, 4 days of tracking, myself and the musicians became very close. It's a magical thing to experience. The rapid transition from strangers to lifelong friends, it doesn't always happen. That's the exact way you could feel like there was something that clicked there.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the players amongst many, Rick Steff, yet again, Memphis legend, playing with her on this record. But, I mean, the thing is, let's talk about her voice. The songs themselves have that Memphis feel. There's a bit of that gospel soul mix. You know, there's emotion, but it's a joyful one. It's not, you know, Lord help me kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a song on there called More with an exclamation point. And it's such a 60s kind of, you know, soul pop stomper, you know, that kind of 4/4 punchy, ironically Motown
yeah.
kind of style. But it's got that feel to it. You know, it's a wonderful, complete and coherent record. It's threaded together perfectly. And I'm absolutely smitten with her.
Yeah. And the other thing about it is that her voice, as you mentioned, I mean, it's crystal clear and it fits the music perfectly. But in a lot of ways, if you compared her to somebody like, you know, another white soul singer, like, female like Joss Stone, her voice is a little less, it's got a little bit softer of an edge to it than Joss Stone's does. And the way that they produced this record, they brought a lot of the backup singers, I think, up a little bit to kind of add some depth to that. And it worked. It worked beautifully. And that, again, it goes back to what you were talking about, the fact that she fell in with this group of very talented musicians and they became friends and they were like, okay, this is what the song needs. This is what we're going to do.
You brought up Joss Stone because I absolutely love her.
How can you not?
I mean, she has a voice that makes you ache.
Right.
And in the best way possible. The thing is, though, that with Joss Stone, I think the emphasis, and I don't know if it's because of the way her records have been produced or this is what she's told to sound like when she sings, it goes too hard in the emphasis of sounding too sultry sometimes for its own good.
Agreed.
Rather than holding back a little bit. You know, with this, it's Emily Barker has a very natural, she's got a powerhouse voice, but it's natural. It flows. She fits her song to the song's needs.
Right.
And I really think it's her deep-rooted love and feeling, keyword love, and understanding of Memphis and the music of Memphis and the history and lineage of that music in Memphis and what recording there physically could possibly do for you. I think all of that mixed together translates into why this album is just so good and so solid.
Yeah.
So the name of it being Sweet Kind of Blue is absolutely on the one. It's a complete package.
Yeah, and that's also the name of the title track that's on the page. You got to hear this one. It's just excellent. So Emily Barker's Sweet Kind of Blue, and it's funny because we have her, an Australian, having that connection with Memphis. The other band that has Nashville just absolutely nailed. And, you know, this is another one that came as a great surprise to me because this band, Midnight North is the name of them, and Under the Lights is the new record. It feels exactly like every authentic Nashville bar on a rolling, rollicking Saturday night.
You know what it is? It's part of that, you know, I know they're a mixed bag kind of band, and their basis is San Rafael, California, but you're absolutely right. They sound more like a band of good time shit kickers.
Yep.
And that's not, you know, there's nothing wrong or negative about that, because who doesn't love good country music on a rollicking Saturday night in a bar? You know, again, you have an automatic image in your mind. You close your eyes and you see a wooden floor and just a good old fashioned, dingy, smoky, shitty bar where people are having a good time drinking, you know.
Yep.
You're flirting with the girls there. It's what a bar experience really should be, not some kind of, I don't even know what you want to call it now, because I haven't been in a bar in I don't know how many years. But the thing is that the music that Midnight North does is they've got that kind of, they have the sense of, yeah, they've got the country basis and feel, but there are times when they know how to be very poppy and very radio friendly. I mean, there is a track on there called Echoes, and I have to tell you, my first thought was it sounded like an REM outtake. You know, the two songs that were going through my mind were both Driver Ready and Texarkana.
I hear my lost heart beating without stop, sir, ever through my mind. Awaken in a frenzy rush, it's never untwined. And I feel some hard days coming my way. So take it away.
Yeah, I can hear that.
But interestingly enough, both those songs do have a very country feel, especially Texarkana. You know, but the thing is, this band, and that's the key thing, they're a band, is they know how to use the instruments to emphasize different points in the song. Some of the songs are driven by a Hammond B3. Some of them are acoustic guitar driven, you know? But they're solid. And that's an important factor. This is another very solid album. I mean, this is only their third. Another one of those episodes where you go, okay, this looks interesting. You know, you read through the press release and it makes you not go, oh, Christ, and roll your eyes.
Yeah.
And put it on the, I'm not going to listen to this one heap. Well, okay, Midnight North. I kind of like the way that the name sounds. I like the way it rolls. And you like the way that they look, because they look so unpretentious and uncharacterized. And, you know, you're going to win me over faster by being yourself than being a certain vein or certain style or certain look, because you're not then prepackaging yourself for bullshit.
What a perfect spot to end, because, and again, Midnight North, you definitely want to check them out. I was watching, and I have to ask you if you saw this. Was watching Stephen Colbert a few days ago, and Joe and Mika were on, and they were, you know, whining about it. Here was the funniest part about it. During that part, did you see this episode? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I didn't, but I heard what happened during that episode.
Okay. first bit of bullshit was that, you know, Stephen Colbert kind of set them up with, well, you know, here's the president, here's the leader of the free world, and he's tweeting about you, Mika, and your supposed facelift. And, you know, how does that feel? And she said, honestly, it's words to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing. She said, you know, honestly, it didn't really bother me that much. Really? Then what were the 2 days right after that tweet came out all about? It didn't bother her that much?
Maybe because she did have a facelift.
Yeah.
She's person. She's a TV personality. And whoever it was who had bothered certainly put her name, stamped her name on it as well.
Well, right. And they, I mean, they both came out and said, oh, we put off our vacation and oh, this is terrible. And it was like, now it doesn't bother her that much. So that was that. But the other thing was that, you know, Joe Scarborough came out later on and said, well, you know, it was effectively, it was the flip of Reagan's quote about how I didn't leave the Democratic Party left me. You know, he gave a little spiel about how the Republicans had not been true to their core values for many years now, and then stepped out and said, well, I'm not going to be a Republican anymore. Now I'm an independent. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, because you're as relevant and valid as what?
Yeah, right.
You're a TV personality.
Right.
You are not in office. You make a lot of money as a TV personality. You're a mediocre guitarist and singer in a pub band, bar band. Although, shockingly, your album, your EP got some decent reviews. They were very kind to you.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit?
Right.
Why should we give them any credence or any time? You know, they went out of their way to make this mountain out of a molehill, you know? Something that I may be overstating this, the obvious here, but hear me out. If you notice, Donald Trump does not fire off angry tweets at the Republican Party, who's been – quite frankly, very good at stonewalling him, just like the Democrats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But he doesn't fire off angry tweets at them because if you notice, they don't bait him. They don't tweet things. They don't write things about him. They don't take shots at him. You know, okay, every now and then, dickless Paul Ryan will say, well, I don't agree with President Trump.
Ooh. Right.
Wow. Shocking, Mr. Backbone. But – you know, you get people like Joe and Mika, you get various sources. And so when they take a shot at Trump, he shoots back, you know. Note to the Democrats, note to the news media. If you really want to help the country and you don't want to see Donald Trump's insane, quote unquote, tweets anymore, don't bait him.
Yeah.
You don't bait him. He's not going to tweet because he's got nothing to tweet about.
I wish I could give credit, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember who said it, but somebody this week effectively made that point and said, look, so far, the Republicans have the presidency and both houses of Congress, and they have done nothing but bumblefuck every campaign promise that they made, up to and including the healthcare thing that they're still not getting through. He said the best thing for the Democrats to do is nothing. Stop. Sit over in the corner. Be quiet. Don't trip over yourself. Don't say anything stupid. In fact, don't say anything at all, because they're doing fine stonewalling themselves.
The thing is also is that unfortunately it's the Clinton Democrats that are the ones that are baiting him.
They can't
unless
shut up. Yeah, right.
Unless perhaps some of them are Bernie bots in Clinton's sheep clothing. You know,
yeah.
We don't know for sure, but because he hasn't had to take any shots at Sanders, but let's see what happens once the wheels start turning on the Jane Sanders investigation. I wonder if there will be a directional shift away from Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton herself has, by and large, kept her mouth shut and her head down and stayed out of the limelight. Yeah, of course, when she makes appearances, you can't help but turn the cameras on her because she's making an appearance. But by and large, she's kept her mouth shut. Listen. There was an appearance this week by President Clinton and President Bush 43, and you know, it was a very interesting. I saw part of the talk that they both gave, and there were some very funny pictures of Clinton kind of, you know, doing a goofy photos in between the statues of the
hiding between the bushes. Yeah.
It's really funny and clever, but there's nothing controversial there, nothing negative to tweet. They're funny. He's a private citizen and he's a charming guy. He's also one of the dirtiest, scummiest presidents we've ever had.
Right.
I loved him. I voted for him twice. I voted for his wife, but let's not lose perspective here. The Clintons are scummy, dirty politicians.
Yep.
They are the embodiment of the machinery, no matter how you look at it. Once you become a politician and you get into the machinery, you are tainted. If I was to run for office, I would go from being this sweet, humble and lovable shoeshine boy to being Darth fucking Vader, except with balls that Vader forgot to keep when he let Luke take the helmet off.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would go exactly the same way, except for I think I would go a little more Jeff Vader, maybe. But it's still at all.
Dan Vader.
That's right. You know, I run the Death Star. But yeah, it is. It's been crazy. But the other thing about that horrifying appearance with Joe and Mika on Stephen Colbert's show was that they ended up with Joe Scarborough's garage band that you referred to a minute ago, simply called Scarborough. And for whatever reason, I decided to go ahead and watch it anyway, even though I knew, okay, this is going to be awful. And it was. It was the most generic pop nonsense that I've heard in a long time, under the guise of trying to sound literate and literary. In fact, I mean, the song that they did was a title that was stolen, I think, from a Vonnegut work or something like that. And so it had nothing really important to say. It was exceptional in its lack of exceptionalism. It was just fairly generic. But the thing that stuck out to me is, oh, he thinks he's Elvis Costello. And I was watching it, and I turned to Jen, and I said, you realize he's copping Elvis Costello? And she said, you think? So she looked up another video, because apparently they made a music video for another one of the songs on this album. And she started laughing, and I said, what's so funny? And she said, well, apparently he's just working on copping his way through every style of the 80s, because in this one, he thinks he's Peter Gabriel. And she showed me the video, and holy shit, if it wasn't Shock the Monkey. I mean, it wasn't that song, but the video and the style of singing and everything else, it was like, oh, he just copped. It was a cross between Shock the Monkey and Sledgehammer, and it was equally generic and stupid. So he has no style. He has nothing to say, and all he can do is copy everybody he admires.
Well, if you wanted to impress me, then you could have done Jeu Sans Frontières in German. You know? that's first of all.
Nice Games Without Frontiers reference. I like that.
Second of all, if you're going to steal something from Vonnegut, you better be referring to people weren't supposed to eat Norwegian hemorrhoid remedy. They're supposed to squirt it up their assholes.
I think we found one in Joe Scarborough.
Sending their kids to school for 8 years of uninterrupted sports fascism and buggery.
Mm-hmm.
So, don't you dare. Not you, but
him. Oh, I get you.
And Vonnegut this one, son. take your horn-rimmed glasses and your bow legs when you're playing. Hey, what kind of guitar was he using? Was he playing a fucking Fender Jazzmaster?
Yes, it was. Yep, exactly.
Douche.
Yep.
Douche.
And on that front, I mean,
we feature on our show here, folks. Whenever we hear something like this, they get the douche buzzer.
Yeah, that's right. Douche of the Week award definitely goes to Joe Scarborough this time around. But on the other hand, going back to what else is going on in the dose, D.W. Dunphy got to talk to a guy, and this, here's what I love about this. He set up his conversation with Butch Vig from Garbage with the fact that he had no idea what to expect going into the interview. And I completely got it. But you know what came out of it, I think, is the fact that Butch came off so full of humor and humanity. I really liked reading that.
Well, the thing is, I've never heard a negative thing from anybody about Butch Vig. He's always struck me as a really nice guy who's, you know, there are a lot of producers who take their role a little too seriously, or they take themselves to being as important, if not more important, than the performers. I mean, I'm sure you've seen interviews with people like Mike Chapman,
yep,
who don't seem to realize that nobody knows who the fuck he is. except for maybe a handful of us who happen to be production aficionados. Or the most important thing is this. First of all, Butch Vig is a musician. Okay?
Right.
We're not talking about production. We're not talking about the band Garbage. I'm talking about, you know, Butch Vig, who played drums in a band called Firetown. Okay?
Yeah.
Who put out, who, by the way, were in fact Garbage minus Shirley Manson. You know, this was, they were on Atlantic Records. This is before I was even at Atlantic. They put out a fantastic album called In the Heart of the Heart Country. So if you can find it, grab it. It's a wonderful, wonderful record. That's number one. Second of all, I don't think he looks at himself as being any kind of, he doesn't look at himself in any special way. You know, he's very come see, come saw about stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he's had health issues over the years that really took, you know, Garbage themselves out of any kind of productivity because he had to get well again, you know, but also the fact that it's already over 26 years since he produced that album that everybody seems to like that I'll never care for. Plus a couple of other albums that I never cared for. It's because it was his job. It was what he was hired to do.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, you have to go into these, and I don't mean DW, but you have to go into reading this as like, okay, what are you going to get? What you're going to get is just very matter-of-fact stuff, and the fact that, you know, he's going out and playing with Garbage again is a really important thing, you know, for him. And, you know, they were a good band. They had their moments, you know. The only reason why I ever paid attention was because A, they had a couple of really good songs, and B, who the hell isn't madly in love with Shirley Manson?
Yeah.
She was like almost the pretender to the throne of Deborah Harry, although no one will ever take Deborah Harry's place in my heart. But, you know, as usual, DW, I think DW's mastery of interviews is the fact that he gets to completely, you know, naturally turn the subjects that he's interviewing quickly back into normal human beings. You know, there's no deification in the process of an interview when DW does it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, they're very warm interviews when you read them. They're very human, and you can't help but really enjoy it and feel satisfied, like, okay, I got a nice glimpse of that person.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, they are. They're incredibly enjoyable things to read. So go check that one out. You know, and again, it doesn't matter. The great thing about it is because of that, it doesn't matter if you're a fan or not, because they're not written from the fan's perspective, and an interview shouldn't be.
Completely correct. There's nothing more dangerous and also just downright lumbering and irresponsible than writing from the fan. Every time I read something that's akin to that, I wind up automatically feeling, I picture that Chris Farley segment with Paul McCartney when Paul McCartney was on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
He has the Chris Farley show. And remember when you were in the Beatles?
stupid. Yeah, it just gets sycophantic and awful really quickly. So, yeah, good for DW for, you know, for avoiding that and just talking to a guy, which is what it really ought to come down to. So definitely want to check that one out as well. Couple of other things going on. We're now into the second half of the baseball season, and I don't know if there's a way to define. I think the first half of the season was surprising in a lot of ways, but we talked about the injury raft a couple of weeks back and the fact that, you know, it seems like baseball is just at this point shrugging its shoulders going, I don't know what we're going to do about this. But when the most interesting thing about the All-Star break was the kid who kept hitting home runs like it was easy, there's nothing left to say other than, well, that was a nice distraction for about 15 minutes, and then the rest of it was just kind of awful.
The All-Star game lost its luster for me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I don't like is the fact that, and I'd say this about, you know, the hockey All-Star game as well, it slows the pace of the season down.
Yep.
That's the only reason why I think the Pro Bowl is done, ironically, the one major sports event that nobody watches. Nobody watches the Pro Bowl. But, you know, stopping the season, I don't care if it's just for 2 days on both sides of the game, it stops the season.
Right.
You know, and this whole fan voting thing, you know, it's so warped and biased that it really has no, there's no sense of an all-star game there.
No.
You know, when I was young, before they started to have the all-star balloting, you know, the managers would always pick the creme de la creme of the previous season, and that's how you did it, and it made sense, and that's why those games were a lot more exciting. I mean, I'm sure you remember as well as I do, Pete Rose plowing right into Ray Fosse in the, what was it, 72 All-Star game.
I think so, yeah.
After that, it just started to turn into boring shit, you know?
Yeah, and even so, the fact, I mean, they tried, because the home team of the World Series depends on who wins and all of that, you know, they tried to inject some kind of meaning into it, and the fact that you have to stop and try to inject some meaning into it means that it that you've lost your way so completely that trying to add some peripheral item onto it to get people interested is just, I mean, you're missing the point.
I think for the longest time, baseball has realized that they are losing their audience. I mean, the whole going to three divisions in each league,
yep,
and then interleague play, and then the introduction of
wild card,
and then the introduction of instant replay. And this year, their new rules with the, you know, you have like a 30-second time limit between pitch. I mean, just all of these nonsensical things to – baseball is not a game meant to be sped up or directed by time frames.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't work that way. And, you know, if you win the All-Star game, it dictates home field advantage. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
It's nonsense. And Aaron Judge from the Yankees hitting, well, but guess what? It's just a hitting contest. Yes, he's doing well in this his rookie season as far as hitting home runs, and congratulations to him. But if that's your focus on it, well, Jesus, there's really nothing there. You're not kidding. The game itself was horseshit until, what, the ninth inning, tenth inning, till you know, the National League managed to fuck it all up yet again, like they always tend to. Oh, and wait a minute. Who was it that blew the game for the National League? Oh, yeah, it was a Cubs pitcher.
Yeah, and it certain kind of poetry to that as well. But you're right. You know, it's not – if you think about – and this is a – radio people talk about this stuff all the time. If you think about the great broadcasters, especially the great, because in my opinion, baseball is always better on the radio anyway, but the great radio broadcasters in baseball, past and present, are the guys who understand that you're not doing play-by-play, you're telling a story. And that's what a baseball game is. It's a story. And if you can't present it, you know, football works much better if you've got a guy who is just matter of fact, here's what's going on. You know, here's you got two guys lined up on the left, one on the right, tight end to the right, and can set the scene for it that way. With a baseball game, it's a lot more poetry than it is play-by-play. And because of that, it doesn't translate terribly well to TV, you know? There's nothing left to the imagination, and that's a lot of what I think the mystique of baseball is.
Well, A, you bring up the most salient point about baseball, which I've said for most of my life. Baseball is poetry. Baseball, I don't care that people say nowadays, you know, football is the great American pastime. No, baseball is. Baseball is the one thing that there will be paintings, that there will be Casey at the bat, you know, they're damn Yankees, and so on and so forth. Baseball is American poetry. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet.
Yeah, right.
And America in a nutshell. And there's nothing wrong with that. And baseball is a beautiful poetic game. And I know George Carlin in his absolute brilliance mocked it, you know, with baseball and football. You know, in football, you wear a helmet. In baseball, you wear a cap.
Right.
In football, the objective is to march downfield and take your enemy's territory. In baseball, the objective is to go home.
Yeah, what was the football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, War Memorial Stadium. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park.
You know, baseball is meant to be poetic. Baseball is meant to tell stories. And, you know, it is true that I would say 90% of most people on TV really are shit, but I got to tell you. And it's not because of my bias as a fan, but when you have a trio like Gary Cohen, who basically does the play-by-play and analysis for, SNY, along with Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling, that is a hell of a trio. Because they're genuinely entertaining.
Yep.
And that's part of it, keeping you entertained. You know, whether it was them rhapsodizing about when Tommy Ramone passed away, they were all talking about how, wow, the all four original Ramones are gone. The other night, Keith Hernandez was talking about Leslie West. I mean, you know, stuff like that.
Well, like a good conversation about Mountain in the middle of a baseball game, sure.
I mean, it's absolutely priceless when they come up with these non sequiturs. I think that they've even got, you know, their own fan pages and stuff like that. And it's because they're, first of all, it's not forced. It's genuinely, it's very, very organic. The humor, the banter, there's a certain chemistry. And no place else are you going to find that than in baseball. And right. I'm sure it's out there. When I was a kid and when I was on my anti-Mets decade, I followed the Phillies. And the first 2 years that I was listening to the Phillies, it was always the triad of, and unfortunately all three of them are no longer with us, Harry Callis, Richie Ashburn, and Byron Song. And I will never forget those three because they had such a wonderfully real old school, old kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? The purity of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're a 10-year-old kid and you're so into baseball, they filled you with facts and figures and history, you know. It's, you know, to this day, I will never forget who threw the Ephus pitch and things like that because of picking up what I learned by watching these games and listening to these guys who knew what they were talking about. So, you know, on one end, you had the original more clinical kind of announcers during a baseball game. Now you've got the more entertaining kind. I'm sure in there you've got a bunch of, you know, drips and dolts.
Sure.
But I know because A, I don't listen to Yankee games, and B, and I'm not an American League guy, and B, I'd just rather listen to Gary, Keith, and Ron ruminating about whatever the hell they're going to ruminate about.
Exactly, yeah. And it's funny because you look at the number of musicians who are huge baseball fans. And I remember watching a thing back in the late 80s, and it was George Thorogood and, who else was there? John Fogerty, who had gone down to a couple of spring training games together in Florida and were just hanging out watching baseball games. And the two of them were so completely into it while the game was going on. And they weren't even real games. It was spring training. So, you know, one of the better things that I heard, you talk about the Mets guys a few years ago, before Jack Buck died, when he was still doing the games for the Cardinals, he and Mike Shannon were in the booth and Bruce Hornsby stopped in. Now, as far as the music goes, I don't even like Bruce Hornsby. You know, it's like, it's fine, but it's not really my thing at all. And the three of them sat up there and talked during the game about baseball and music and life. And it was just so completely capturing of your attention that you couldn't tune away. You know, it was just wonderful, wonderful radio.
Somebody in a certain, from a certain area, in a completely different light, a light, yep, that you completely relate to. Case in point with the Met broadcasts, and especially ever since SNY came on the air, Jerry Seinfeld is almost a regular, and yep, a regular commentator. You know, they'll always look to see if he's in his box. And in his box is usually with him Chris Rock. One time, unexpectedly, Seinfeld showed up and he brought a guest with them who took over the game for about three innings, and it was Robin Williams.
Oh, wow.
You know, and apparently Robin Williams was both a Mets and Giants fan. Giants because he grew up in San Francisco, and Mets because he lived in New York for so many years.
Yep.
You know, you get people just coming in all the time to do games. And you know, Seinfeld actually can sit there and call a game with them and know what the hell he's talking about and sound like an actual commentator.
Yeah.
You know, instead of, who are these people and what are they doing in my home?
What is the deal with hot dogs anyway? That's
the master of my domain.
Oh, yeah. So that's part of the formula for it. And unfortunately, it needs an attention span that we're trying desperately to wring out of society. So I don't know.
Just to bring up one more, every spring training for at least a decade, you would always see down at the Mets camp, the one and only Snake Plissken.
There you go. Yeah. Kurt Russell.
Because Kurt Russell, A, his dad owned a team up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an independent league team. And B, his nephew, Matt Franco, played for the Mets.
Okay.
So he was always there. Big Met fan. So anyway, so there you go. I mean, it's a great thing, and you know, you treasure that kind of stuff when you see them just as they are hanging out because they love the game.
Exactly.
They're not there for any other purpose.
We've got in our heads to get to before we get to the end of this one. And, you know, again, I don't know what the cure is, but we'll see what happens to get people's attention throughout the second half of this season. Where are the Mets, by the way, right now?
They're losing right now 14-3 to the Rockies after beating them two nights in a row, 13-3 and then 9-2 yesterday. Steven Matz looked as bad as the Rockies pitchers did these last 2 days. The Mets are, I think, 6 games under 500. I unfortunately think that they're going to be sellers by the deadline. They're not going to make the postseason, but again, it is simply because of all the injuries that have plagued this team.
Right.
Last night, just again, and you may see it if you look it up, but Yoenis Cespedes, even though he's not on the disabled list, hurt his hip by making a very weirdly awkward slide trying to catch a ball out in the field. And when you watch, his knee takes a huge divot out of the grass, a huge lump of, and he apparently, you know, his hip is bugging him a little bit after that.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that's a knee injury right there or an ankle injury because you see this big shard of grass come up and stay up. You know, I mean, that was plowed by a knee.
Yep.
The Mets, unfortunately, this is a very sadly lost season. And coming out of the All-Star break, General Manager Sandy Alderson had said we need to have a really great second half and homestand before we do anything. And winning 2 out of 3 from the very bad Rockies, because the Rockies have lost something like, I think it's 16 of their last 18 games. They've been on a downward spiral ever since they got swept by the Dodgers. You know, they should have won today's game. Steven Matz should have had it. He didn't have it after the third pitcher. He gave up 9 runs in an inning and a third.
Yeah.
I'm used to it by now, unfortunately.
Yeah, understood. As we get to the In Our Heads segment, there is one thing that I happen to have my Amazon app on my phone pick out this week that was of particular interest, and I absolutely love the song, but it started me to thinking about something because on the tribute album, the Warren Zevon tribute album, Enjoy Every Sandwich, his son Jordan did a song called Studebaker, which was up until the Preludes release was an unreleased demo recording that Warren Zevon had written back, I don't know, 1978 or 79, and it's a great song, as most of his are. It's got a real kind of a desperation to it.
Left my home in Monterey, just another no prospects man, who'd rather work in the foundries than put fishes in a can. I'm 25, but I haven't traveled far, and I spend all my money on this misbegotten car. I'm up against it all, like a leap against the wind, and the Studebaker keeps on breaking.
Jordan, of course, did a wonderful job with it on the tribute album and everything. But as I was sitting there listening, I thought, you know, what a great piece of sort of Americana and romance that over the years, and I said we were going to get back to Jan and Dean way earlier on in this conversation, that the car has been a piece of subject matter that so many people have waxed rhapsodic about. And it's a particularly American phenomenon. I mean, our love affair with the automobile has been long and storied. And, you know, it's a little different now because the cars are different. I mean, they all kind of look the same. But back when, to steal a line from My Favorite Year, back when a Buick looked like a Buick and a Pontiac looked like a Pontiac, it was not uncommon at all. And in fact, the birth of rock and roll was tied very much to that love affair with, you know, 57 Chevys and all of that. So, that song Studebaker was a different take on it. It was about what a piece of shit he was driving and how it was a metaphor for his life falling apart, the character in the song. And yet the love songs to the Cars, all the way from Jan and Dean through to Van Halen, some of the great Car songs that have been out there. I wonder if there is one that sticks out to you as a particular favorite.
She's real fine, my 409.
Yeah.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I save my pennies and I save my dimes. Giddy up, 409. Before I knew there would be a time. Giddy up, 409. When I would buy a brand new 409.
Youthful and joyful.
Yep.
You know, it's about as pure and as innocent as you could possibly get. But you know, you made me think just by talking about Cars and going back to the beginning of rock and roll, you know, Something Else by Eddie Cochran, you know? I got that car and I'm thinking to myself, that car's fine looking, man. That's something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you mentioned 409. I mean, being a Mopar guy, a little old lady from Pasadena, as goofy a song as that is, it starts with that brand new shiny red super stock Dodge.
Yep. Or Bucket Tea, yeah. Which The Who covered, but is a Jan and Dean song.
Yeah. Right?
Found on a barn in Tennessee, paid $5 for a bucket tea. Took me 3 years of sweat and blood just to clean up all that Tennessee mud. My bucket tea. Bucket tea. My bucket tea. Bucket tea.
And of course, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. My papa said, son, you're going to drive me to drink it if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln.
You know, the car songs are just, there are just so, so many. Drive my car.
That's but right. Chuck Berry had more than a few.
Oh, hell yes. The Car, without a doubt, is a staple of American rock and roll. It is. What did I say before? Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, Chevrolet.
Chevrolet, right. And you it's know? Freedom. It's rock and roll is about freedom and rebellion and being able to go off on your own and do what you want. And how are you going to get there? Behind the wheel of your brand new car.
All I can say is you can't get there from here.
Well done. And of course, you know, Van Halen with a revival of it in the mid-80s with Panama. But yeah, there's so many great ones. And we're going to pop a couple on here at the end of this conversation just to sort of bring them back into memory. But that's what the comment section is for as well. So if there's one that we missed, then by all means, if you've got a favorite car song, put it in there. And that's about all I got for you this week, Rob Ross. Have yourself a great rest of your week. And I know we'll have a ton to go over next time we get together on Radio City.
Absolutely, my brother. Be well, God bless, and we'll see you all next week if the bomb don't drop.
You got it. God willing and the creek don't rise, and we'll see you then. Thanks a lot for listening.